WISR now presents It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. Dave is off today, so we have a special guest host. It's Your Turn is Butler County's only live call-in talk show. You can join in the conversation by calling 724-283-2525. And now, let's join It's Your Turn and today's special guest host.
Welcome to the program, listeners. Tyler Friel, WISR 680 AM in Butler. It's your turn. And yes, we are back in action. Myself and Kayla Molzan in for Dave Malarkey on this Tuesday, December 19th, 2017. We are just now a week inside of Christmas. Yes, that's right. It's only 6 days away now. Next Monday, the 25th, is what we're looking at for Christmas. And I was telling the listeners earlier, Kayla, still have yet to do that holiday shopping.
It's sad that a week from today, it'll all be over.
In terms
of just Christmas. I mean, I consider the whole, you know, through New Year's Day to be a holiday, even though a lot of us have to work in between and, you know, whatnot.
Well, we do play Christmas music, even though Christmas is over. We're not one of those stations will play Christmas music the whole way.
Yeah, I do like that.
Yeah, some people don't, but some people do.
It's too abrupt when you wake up on the 26th after, like, some people, you know, you start listening. Some people do in, like, October.
Yeah.
And then you wake up on the 26th and it's like, oh, okay.
It's past midnight.
Now we're done.
Exactly. But we don't do that here. We're going to be playing Christmas music the whole way through the Russian Orthodox Christmas, I believe, is the date that we run that to. Also, it's an open talk portion of the program today. 724-283-2525 is the phone number, and we also have a litany of guests to get to. Our first guest will be Chris Calhoun. Mm-hmm. He's a professor out at Butler County Community College and the coordinator of the Parks and Recreation Program out there, among many other things. He is an expert in water rescue, and he's a part of the water rescue team in Butler County, and we're going to talk to him, Kayla, about ice safety.
Yeah, and this is all stemming from a big news story that we were following yesterday and today of that accident that happened at Moraine State Park, Lake Arthur, yesterday morning. There was a gentleman, he's been identified now as a 71-year-old from Pittsburgh, who unfortunately was took to the ice yesterday, was attempting to do some ice fishing, and fell through the ice and ended up losing his life. It's timely because a lot of people go to Moraine State Park 365 days of the year. You know, it's just not a summer destination. And there are a lot of popular ice activities, ice fishing being one of them. So we wanted to reach out to Chris, who I would say is an expert in this field. He trains water rescue teams, which several of them were at Moraine yesterday dealing with this situation. We're going to talk to him about, you know, just some tips. How do you know when it's safe to go out there on the ice? What happens if you get out there and the ice starts to crack? What do you do? And he has some very good tips that we're going to talk about. What should you bring with you? Another person is probably the best one to have somebody else with you. You can bring a rope. You can bring other types of equipment to help you in that situation. But, you know, it's right in our backyard. It's Moraine State Park. A lot of people go. And unfortunately, we had this horrific accident happen yesterday. We won't have any more of those this winter season.
So make sure you listen up for the tips that Chris provides and different things of that nature. I've never gotten into the ice fishing, but I'm on ice I don't want to say often in the winter, but we've done pond hockey before. My friends and I, you know, we'll go out, we'll play pond hockey on a number of ponds in the area. These are things that you really do have to think about, and when you're putting that many people of, you know, grown men out on the ice moving around at a consistent rate, these are the types of things that we should really be paying attention to.
Have you ever been scared? Like, have you ever
it
had
cracked
anything?
Once, yeah.
Really?
We were playing on a certain pond, and it was actually the biggest guy out there. He was a linebacker for Slippery Rock, as it turned out. And he was going to chase after a puck, and he just started, and it was like a movie. When he was on the shallow end, and it started cracking, and he had to, like, bounce from one over, one over, one over. He was very close to the edge, but at that point, it was, all right, everybody off, we're scattering. And it was probably too mild. Again, it probably a similar weather situation, but it was later in the winter, so we had thought maybe it had, you know, still been thick enough. But again, just a situation like that. So I've been there before when ice has cracked, but not in the same type of conditions, I guess.
Just talking a little bit and planning this interview with Chris on the phone this morning, he mentioned that a lot of the times these accidents happen, people go through the ice, it's close to the edge.
Yeah.
You know, and that, and he said that that is the area, like by the shoreline, it freezes last and it thaws first.
Yep.
So that, you know, sometimes you're not that far away, but you could still have a horrific ending.
We had a pond where I was at growing up, still there, obviously. And then that's where you can tell that the pond is where it's bad at, where it drains especially.
Right.
That
right.
one, because there's always a lot of moving water. And there was a spring underneath our pond, so rarely did it freeze. At times it had, and we have played hockey on it before, mm-hmm. but we have found the closer you get to the center, the better off you actually are in terms of the thickness. That's just in my experience. I don't want to be an expert on that. We'll leave that to Chris to dissect. But no, this is, I think, a lot of situations where a lot of teenagers, because of pond hockey, even anybody does ice fishing. And so I think there's a lot of good takeaways mm-hmm. from this interview, hopefully, that we have with Chris.
Yeah, Moraine State Parks, it's so beautiful there in the winter. It really is. I had my engagement pictures taken there a couple years ago. It's so pretty. So I understand the draw. And like even just like an amateur just going out to the park and being like, oh, I want to walk across. I mean, it's cool. Yeah. It's a cool thing to do. But you have to be careful. You have to be aware.
So we'll talk with Chris Calhoun about that. We'll also talk, or rather, you had a chance to chat with Marita Williams, holiday travel. It's that time of year.
Yeah, I'm excited for this. We know that the Thanksgiving holiday numbers were up, and AAA says that Christmas holiday numbers are going to be up as well. They consider the holiday travel period to start on Saturday, which is the 23rd, and go the whole way through January 2nd. So I'm hoping I can ask her to give us some tips on, you know, if you are driving, which most of us still do, driving is the number one, followed by flying and trains, cruise ships, you know, all that stuff. But when's the best time to leave? And this will be interesting to hear what she has to say, because with Christmas Day being on a Monday, will a lot of people leave on Saturday? Will they leave on Friday?
Yeah.
You know, will they wait till Sunday, Christmas Eve morning? I don't know.
There's a lot of different ideas, a lot of different ways people travel. And I do think we're in an interesting work week this year when it comes to Christmas. Technically, and I would assume most places aren't closing this week at any time. Like typical office places mm-hmm. that are open Monday through Friday. I mean, you're working till the 22nd, Christmas Eve on Sunday. So technically, it's like a three-day weekend for a lot of people.
Right.
Which in some instances is kind of nice, because
right.
no matter what, you are going to get 3 days off for the holiday.
Right.
As opposed to a place like us, you know, that we just have Christmas Day off. So if it falls on a Wednesday, you work Monday, Tuesday, and then you work Thursday and Friday.
Right, yeah. Right in the middle of the week. Yeah, that is true.
Now, I think I've seen a lot of places just in my experience that this is a big week for people to take off, but next week is a really big week for people to take off.
Yeah, and especially with it falling, like we said, on a Monday, a short week to begin with already, and then people use up that holiday time.
So we'll talk holiday travel, and then we're also going to be talking honeybees. This is Tracy Morgan's topic. She had a chance to talk with Joe Skrzynski, from the Country Barn Farm.
Mm-hmm. That's in the Gibsonia area. I think it's in O'Hara Township specifically. And this is interesting. Tracy came up with this idea and said, can I talk honeybees? I was like, sure. She said that there's been a lot of news stories. People might have seen them talking about the worldwide decline of honeybees. There is one. I
have heard that. Yeah.
There's a high number of them dying. And Joe will explain that that's happening right here in Western Pennsylvania as well, and what that means in terms of, you know, the honey consumption throughout the country and the world. But yeah, I think it'll be a really interesting to hear what Joe has to say from the Country Barn Farm.
So we're a little all over the place today,
but
that's good. We'll try to keep a decent variety for you coming your way on the It's Your Turn program. We are starting with Open Talk. 724-283-2525 is the phone number. You got something on your mind you want to talk about, please feel free to give Kayla and myself a call. We'll be glad to chat with you. I wanted to start with a story that's been the lead story on the CBS News and for really most of the national programs. And this is something that we talked about very briefly yesterday because we didn't have that much information on it, but this train derailment in Seattle. And I've only heard bits and pieces of, you know, this story being put together. Was there any, they're saying speed is a factor.
Mm-hmm.
Are they having any reasons as to why that train was going so fast in an area where it wasn't? I mean, we're looking at a train going 80 miles per hour when it was only supposed to be going 30.
Yeah.
And the speed limit was 30.
Right. It was a 30 mile per hour zone. And yeah, I know that NTSB has already started their investigation, which they do rather swiftly when these things happen. And from what I was learning this morning watching CNN, they will look at, you know, the engineer's cell phone to see if he was using his phone. They're not allowed to be using their phones at all on these Amtrak services. So was he using his phone? They'll test his blood and his urine to make sure he wasn't under the influence of anything. Or it could just be, you know, they'll try to figure out if it's just human error and was he just going too fast. One piece of information that I don't think we had yesterday was this was the first route of this train. This was a new service. Which is kind of interesting because yesterday locally we had the story of the Butler Transit Authority and their Butler to Pittsburgh service.
Yeah.
That was the inaugural ride yesterday morning. And so this was the inaugural ride of this Amtrak train in the Seattle area. So that's kind of interesting, but how horrific. I mean, they spent millions of dollars building this, and I know they had to acquire some areas and put in some additional track and whatnot, but it was the first morning, the first rush hour of this new route, and that something this awful happens. It's kind of
crazy. That's wild. Yeah. It was really weird to hear the developments come out about that, just because there were so many little nuances to the story that you probably didn't think were there. I mean, I think when we first saw this story, it just looked like something and bizarre had happened. You know, maybe a train just got off the tracks on a morning commute and that was it. But you see how fast he was going, that it was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of intricacies into that story that really made my eyebrows raise this morning.
Well, the first thing we noticed was the pictures, because they look like they were out of a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it really did. And amazing that, as far as I know, no one underneath on the highway was killed. And I mean, if you saw the pictures, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That no one driving down the road was killed, because the train was literally dangling and it looked like it had hit the road in some spots.
That it looked like a movie that
was
just
from Superman
released.
Or Spider-Man or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
crazy.
That's going to be a story, I think, that's going to be well worth keeping our eyes on as we roll throughout the rest of the week, is just because there's, I think, a lot of questions that surround that particular story.
I wonder if people are over, if we transition now for a second to the Steelers, since we spent so much time
on
the topic yesterday. I know Tomlin holds his press conference. Did it begin at noon?
Yeah, it began at noon, and I actually was should have been in the office a little bit earlier, but I decided to stay in the car to try to catch the opening comments.
What did he have to say?
I didn't catch enough of it. This was one that stood out when he was talking about the terminology "survive the ground," which was the big phrase that apparently a lot of NFL fans have now learned. He said, "I'm so tired of talking about it. You guys know what we teach, catch the football." And he ended it there. One thing that you can say about Mike Tomlin that, again, I like about him more than Bill Belichick, he gives you answers. He gives you sound bites. There is something there. When a reporter asks a question, for the most part, Mike Tomlin's going to answer that, which is, you know, from our side, it's kind of nice to have.
Right. And I mean, I like that he's blunt and straightforward and to the point, you know, which I'm sure for some of those reporters, it makes their job a little harder sometimes.
Because they have to write down and try to track all these different ones with Belichick. All you get, we won the game. Good win. They were a good team.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely dominated everybody's conversation yesterday.
Yes.
After leaving here, turned on some other radio stations, everybody's talking about it. Go to the mall, everybody, you know, it's just like the water cooler conversation.
And it was funny because, you know, it wasn't even just sports talk that was talking about it. It was news talk. It was the news. Mm-hmm. Like, this was the top story. Again, I just find it fascinating what dominates the conversation when it comes to Pittsburgh after a tough Steelers loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the Penguins, by the way, not to get on a sports tangent, but that's not a surprise with me, that they're really struggling. They're 17 and 15 and 2 overall, really struggling in terms of points. Now, the NHL is a long season, so I don't think anybody's panicking, especially since the Steelers are doing so well.
Exactly.
But once that Steelers season ends and people look at the standings and go, hey, oh, the Penguins aren't doing that well, then the panic will set in. But maybe the ship will be corrected by then.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully.
Well, did you see the story about how Pennsylvania has so far been spared from the flu epidemic?
I have not.
Yes, yeah, so right.
That's good news, though.
Yeah, good news. Now, hopefully it's not a ticking time bomb when it comes to it. But right now, it's really stayed out of the fray. So far, there have been a dozen states that have reported widespread flu epidemics: Arkansas, California, Connecticut, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Missouri, New York, Ohio, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Wisconsin. So two neighboring states have been affected by it. Pennsylvania, not as much. There's actually only been 25 reported cases of the flu in Butler County.
Wow.
That's not bad.
But I always hesitate when we go with, and we have to use these numbers because that's what's given to us and
there's
provided.
Been more than 25 people
right.
with the flu.
A lot of people who get the flu don't go to the doctor. You know, they stay at home and get better, just, you know, whatever. Everybody has their own version of how to combat the
absolutely.
Flu.
Now, do you do the flu shot?
I do not.
Okay.
I do not. And I've done, you know, we've done stories. We talked to a couple of Butler Health System doctors just this year that we've had in the news, and they all greatly advocate for the flu shot. I've just never been one. I never have gotten it.
To go out of your way to do it?
Right. If, you know, when I'm older, that might be a different story. Young children, you know, that's a different story. It just depends, you know, and if you're dealing with other health issues where you can't get sick, you know, that's something obviously is more important.
And it is a matter of convenience for me. Like if I'm at the pharmacist or wherever flu shots are provided and they say, hey, have you gotten a flu shot? I say, no, I'll take one. But if I'm not in that situation, then I don't go out of my way.
So you vary year to year whether you
I'm not really hard on any. I mean, that's kind of just the way I operate with most things, you know, like even lunchtime.
Convenience is number one.
No, I'll go back and forth on it. And I don't have, a hard opinion either way. It's like if someone says, here it is, I'll do it. If there are listeners out there that have very hard opinions on the flu shot, we'll take your call. We are in the open talk portion of today's show. 724-283-2525 is the number. About another 5-10 minutes of open talk before we get a chance to chat with Chris Calhoun. So, yeah, it looks like now the experts are saying that the flu is probably going to be here, you know, expected to come. But, hey, maybe you get away with it on the holidays.
I know. It's so – well, yeah, hopefully you don't get sick for the holidays. That would be awful. I don't know if I've just been more paranoid this year or not, but I've been, like, hyper aware of how – easy it is to spread germs.
Oh, yeah.
Just in everyday life. You know what I mean? Especially working here. Because we're all, that's what my family says. They're like, you're always, you know, you.
We're in a petri dish.
Right. When you use the same microphones and whatnot. But even in day to day life, you know, you go to the gas station to pump gas. How many people have touched that?
Yep.
Money, you know, it's all that stuff. And I just don't want to get sick for the holidays. And I've just been hand sanitizing.
Do you hand sanitize
them? I try to as much as I can. I don't think it helps as much as washing your hands, but you can't wash your hands every 5 minutes.
I know.
You just can't, you know?
Well, I tried to do it. There was a cold going around the office, and I really went out of my way. I'm like, I'm going to wash my hands. I'm going to really do my
duty. You still got it, didn't you?
Still got it. Like, I took extra precautions. Yeah. I did not want it. Now, I will give our own Tracy Morgan credit. This was her idea, and I will give her credit for it. I don't know if it worked or if this was just where I was in the cold symptoms, but I had a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar and a clove of garlic before I went to bed. Now, I was probably about 2 or 3 days into the cold symptoms. I woke up the next day, felt a lot better, another teaspoon of the vinegar. Before I went to bed, another teaspoon of the vinegar. No one wanted to talk to me for a day and a half. But then I woke up the next day. I was shocked. I felt like I was at the end of the cold.
That's so interesting you say that because apple cider vinegar, I think that this year,
that was
like,
the thing that took off.
It's like one of the things. Like, you know how we have things every year?
Absolutely.
Apple cider vinegar was the answer to so many people's ailments.
Want to lose weight? Apple cider vinegar.
I mean, they say that this stuff just has so many health benefits, and it's obviously all natural. I know we have a lot of some people from DeWalt's Health Foods on various programs here at the Butler Radio Network, and I know you can get it there. It's interesting, though, you know, and it's cheap and it's natural. Maybe we should all try it in 2018.
I mean, I got a bottle of it for like $2.50, and I was.
Did it hurt to take?
It does not taste.
It didn't
good.
Burn.
Didn't burn. It just doesn't taste good. I mean, you take it, you're like, whoo.
But it doesn't burn.
What was worse was the clove of garlic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an Italian meal.
Chop it up and mince it up.
Apparently, you're supposed – this is what I did. I minced it up, and then you're supposed to let it, you know, sit out for like 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And let the enzymes kick in or something like that. Again, this was just something Tracy had told me.
Yeah.
And
she's done it a lot, though.
That's what she tells me, and I've never seen her with a cold, or if I do, it's for like a day or two, and – she seems better. I mean, it's all natural, so I'm like, yeah, what the heck?
It's not going to hurt you.
It's not going to hurt me. It's just going to taste bad. Maybe it'll work. And It did. Just saying.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was thoroughly impressed with it.
Hmm.
So I don't know if I, you know, get the flu. Maybe I'll just chug
a
bottle of that.
Back pocket for next year.
And it was just a teaspoon, too. It wasn't like anything.
Yeah, you don't have to chug the whole bottle or anything.
Exactly. It was bitter, but yeah, what the heck? I mean, it seemed like it worked. So the other story I wanted to touch upon real quick was the FBI moving an office, or directing their office, rather, in the Pittsburgh area to be a little bit stronger with violent crimes, because they've seen an uptick in it in this particular region.
This was actually, they're going to create a task force. So the FBI has a Pittsburgh field office. They're going to create a special task force. Basically, that just means more money, more manpower, more focus on this one particular area, which, as you said, is violent crimes. And it was interesting to me. I mean, they said that they looked at their statistics and that the violent crimes happening in several counties outside of Pittsburgh, which we are obviously one of them here in Butler County, that the violent crimes per capita was more in some of those counties than it was in Philadelphia. And that really stuck out to me, you know, because obviously a big city on the eastern side of the state. I'm not surprised, though, because even following the news in Butler County, we've had several homicides. You know, we've had several bank robberies, kidnappings, all that stuff. And the FBI saying yesterday when talking about the creation of this task force is they think that it's all or mostly all connected to the opioid crisis in one way or another, which I think when you look at what's happening in Butler County, you would have to agree.
Well, even you look at the tri-state area, specifically West Virginia, where they do have an opioid epidemic as well. And so you wonder if that has any correlation as to why it's more prevalent here than it is in Philadelphia. And maybe the economics of Philly, especially in the suburban areas, are perhaps a bit better than what they are in Pittsburgh. Pure speculation on my part is why, you know, maybe that opioid and violent crime rates are higher on this side of the state. But yeah, again, that was another story that really caught my eye. That there, I mean, there are serious concerns. And obviously, like you said, people in Butler County, people in Butler are very familiar with the opioid crisis that we are facing here. And then I think that has now reached to higher ups, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I wonder if anybody, I know the story we had yesterday, and I wonder if any of our listeners have driven by the old Worsley site on Main Street
in Butler.
A very, very visual, you know, some think it's touching, some have other feelings for it, but either way, I think you can just say that it is impactful, especially being right there on Main Street. They had a group of people from various agencies, just individuals. It wasn't run by one agency, but they put up a wooden cross and with a wreath and a purple ribbon signifying addiction. And for each person that have lost their lives in Butler County in 2017 to addiction. And I believe now the number is 84. So there's 84 crosses there. You know, that's impactful. That's right on Main Street. People are going to see that, and it's a sobering reminder of what's happening in our county.
When you see the visual representation of it, when you see the symbols that you can, you know, touch and with the visuals that are there, I think that's when it really hits you.
Yeah. Well,
you hear 83, it's a lot, but then you see it, and you're like, huh.
You see there's a cross, and just think, that is a person that this time last year was here.
Yeah.
You know, and now they're not here. And I agree with you. When you hear the number, you obviously know it's a lot. But when you see that there's a cross for each person, it's really staggering.
Yeah. And I think one thing that Butler should be commended for in their actions of what they've done here is they have acknowledged the issue and then trying to take steps to address that problem. And I know it's a cliche phrase, but the first step in the recovery process, or at least trying to fix a problem, is the acknowledgement that it's there. And I think now we've gotten to a point where, as a country, we've realized that there is an opioid problem. And in this particular county, we have realized it as well. The steps to going about and fixing that is up to minds greater than mine, greater than yours. It's going to be a collective effort, no question. But I think the visual representation around this time of year, especially, too, as you said, very sobering.
Yeah. I took a couple calls yesterday after our story ran of people who were upset about it and thought that maybe it was inappropriate. And what I would say to that is, at least they're not pretending like it's not a problem here. You know, they're not. And the people behind this want to not only honor the lives that were lost, but to also put a visual to it and say, this is what's happening, and it's happening here whether you want to believe it or not.
Yeah. So with that, we'll take a break.
All righty.
Kind of a little of a depressing note to take a break on. But we've got some tips that we really do think will be informative for you if you are an ice fisher or if you have a relative that does any type of activities on the ice. As we are going to have a chance to talk with Chris Calhoun. He is a professor out of Butler County Community College and much more. He's their coordinator of Parks and Recreation. He is also a member, assistant chief, I believe, of the water rescue team in Butler County. So he knows what he's talking about, and we're going to have a chance to talk to him next. It's all coming up right here on It's Your Turn, WISR 680 AM.
Hearing aids are a complex issue, but at the heart of it, we really want just a few simple things. We want to be able to hear well, to get personalized care, and all at a reasonable cost. Well, a simple chat with Hearing Services by Kelly, and you'll find that she stands above the rest. She's not going to sell you the highest price hearing aid just to make a sale. In fact, you'll save thousands of dollars because there isn't any overhead. With Kelly, you get experience and one-on-one personalized care that you don't get anywhere else. Call the hearing aid lady today. Phone number 724-756-4327. That's 724-756-4327. Her customers who made the change are so happy they did, and you will be too. 724-756-4327.
Well, the holidays are coming, and that means your office will start receiving tasteless tins of popcorn, boring baskets of fruit and nuts, and a plethora of 2018 calendars. Ugh. Give your clients something better, something memorable, and something that says Butler. Like a custom gift box from Cummings Candy and Coffee, you can choose from an assortment of chocolate-covered chips, pretzels, graham crackers, and cherry cordials. Add in a half-pound bag of Butler's own proprietary blend of coffee, the Main Street Roast. Call Barry for your corporate order. Cummings Candy and Coffee, serving the Butler community since 1905 and now in three locations.
Welcome back, listeners, to It's Your Turn here on WISR 680 AM. I'm Kayla Molzan, joined alongside Tyler Friel, filling in today for Dave Malarkey. We wanted to talk about one of the big stories that we've been working on in the newsroom yesterday and today was this unfortunate accident that happened Monday morning at Moraine State Park's Lake Arthur. A fisherman attempting to ice fish fell through the ice and unfortunately did die. The 71-year-old from Pittsburgh's body was recovered by a dive team early yesterday afternoon. You know, we wanted to talk ice safety, and to do this, we wanted to bring in somebody that can talk a lot about it, and that's Chris Calhoun. He's the BC3 professor and coordinator for the Park and Recreation Management Program at the college. I know he does a number of other things as well, including working for the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission as a wildlife conservation education specialist, lead water rescue instructor trainer since the late 1980s. Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to help out and provide any information that I can.
Now, you know, ice activities are popular. Are they safe?
One of the things that I like to tell people is that there's absolutely no such thing as safe ice. So a lot of people are not aware that there are many factors that influence the strength of ice and the thickness of ice. And when ice forms, it does not form in a uniform manner. So there's all kinds of factors that actually influence the formation of ice. Mm-hmm. That would be the temperature. If it's nice and cold and we have a long cold snap, that's great. Unfortunately, we live in western Pennsylvania where the temperatures go up and down rapidly. Wind can actually influence or speed up or slow down the formation. Current that's in the water, an area if it's hit by sunlight or not hit by sunlight, and anytime we have water or snow on the surface, that actually greatly influences the strength of ice. And finally, a couple other things. If there's structures, any structure in the water, that actually absorbs heat. So areas around a structure, be it a tree or a stump or a bridge pier, can be a problem. And bridges are also heavily salted, and that salt typically drains down through drain holes and goes onto the ice mantle. And finally, there's some tiger traps that are out there. And what I mean by that is if there's an underwater spring in the body of water, that water is actually warmer and it rises to the top, and it'll create an area of weaker ice. So in terms of are activities safe, the first thing to always keep in mind is that ice is never safe.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be evaluated by the person that's going out there on the ice.
I mean, that's a lot of factors that you just rattled off. You know, if, for somebody that who does want to go out to Moraine this winter, that can be daunting. I know I was talking to the Moraine State Park manager, Dustin Drew, and he told me that he doesn't, them as a park, they don't measure the ice thickness just because there's too many factors and that it can be different, you know, in various spots of the lake. What's the one, you know, if you had to pick a couple things to evaluate first, is there something that we can do if somebody is bound and determined to go out there?
Well, there's a couple things. The Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission recommends a minimum of 4 inches of clear ice for anyone that's going out onto the water. Now, again, all the factors that I just listed means that it's not uniform 4 inches the entire way across the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So many things can affect that. So if somebody's going out onto the lake, they personally need to be evaluating that. Most of the ice fishermen will utilize an auger and measure as they go. I think the biggest thing that I would like to stress is if you're going out onto the ice, excuse me, wear a personal flotation device, a life jacket. That's critical. Most people don't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they look at it as, hey, it's the ground, we're just walking out across. But when you fall through the ice, that water temperature is 32 degrees. It will immediately cause what we call cold water shock, hyperventilation, immediate disorientation, and a person's going to struggle with the impact of that cold temperature. So if you're wearing a life jacket, it does two things. First, life jacket gives you a little additional thermal protection because of its thickness.
Mm-hmm.
Second, it keeps you on the surface of the water, and it keeps you buoyant. It does take a while for water rescue assets to get to a scene, and if you've got something that will help keep you afloat where you can hold on to the edge of the ice mantle if you can't get yourself out,
mm-hmm.
that life jacket is what may mean the difference between a rescue or a recovery.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that when you say when you fall in that you can feel the effects instantly. Like even if you are a swimmer, a strong swimmer, and you're thinking, I'll be fine, that cold water really does affect your body instantaneously.
Oh, it's huge. You know, I like to explain it a couple of different ways. If you were taking a shower and you lose all the hot water, you get that immediate gasp,
mm-hmm.
And it's chilly, but you can easily get out, and it's not a problem. When you fall through the ice, you know, compound that by 10 or 20. And that cold just does not go away. And besides the cold water temperature, you're also dealing with the cold temperatures of the ambient air temperature. So you got a lot of things that are happening. And again, that personal flotation device, if I could just get people to be wearing that when they're going out onto the ice, you know, you hope you never fall through, but falling into that cold water, that's brutally cold, and it will immediately have an impact on you.
What do you do, Chris, if you are out on the ice and it begins to crack? You haven't fallen in yet, but you notice, mm-hmm. oh, geez, you know, I could be in trouble here. Is there anything that you can immediately do to kind of help your chances of not falling in?
Yep, absolutely. There's a couple of things. When you travel out on the ice, you should never walk. You should actually slide and shuffle. And what that sliding and shuffling does is that it actually distributes your weight over a greater surface area. Now, if you walk like you do normally on land, when you lift your leg, whatever your total body weight is,
mm-hmm.
all of that weight is going down on that other leg. And so you're concentrating all that weight in one area. So sliding and shuffling is a great way to travel across the ice. If the ice begins to crack, immediately lay down onto the ice mantle. You know, a lot of people will attempt to run. Immediately lay down. Turn around and go back in the exact direction that you just came from. And the reason you want to do that is that you know that the direction that you just came from, that ice mantle was strong enough to hold you to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So lay down, crawl back in the direction that you just came, and get off the ice.
Mm-hmm. As quickly as possible.
As quickly as possible.
We're talking with Chris Calhoun. He's a professor out at BC3 and coordinator for the Parks and Recreation Management Program at the college. Chris, you mentioned wearing a personal flotation device when you're out on the ice. Is there anything else you can wear or have with you that would be there for safety precautions?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of things. Devices that are known as ISOLs, and to describe to your listeners what that would actually be, you can make them. They're basically like a large dowel rod that you drill a hole in the bottom of, and you put a masonry nail into it, and then you cut the head off, and then you resharpen it. You can buy those devices also commercially, so you can make it or you can buy it personally. The problem when you fall through the ice is that there's nothing to grab onto to get yourself up and out of the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do ice rescue training, that's one of the first skill sets that I teach my students, is I show them literally how difficult it is to come up and out of a hole without any tools, nobody pulling on you with a rope, no ISOLs, and literally how challenging that is. So what the ISOLs allow you to do is they allow you to plunge the nail into the ice, and that gives you some leverage so that you can kick yourself up
mm-hmm.
and pull yourself up onto the mantle and roll away. Some other things that you can do is definitely not be going out onto the ice alone. When you're traveling, don't travel together. Spread yourselves out a little bit. But by having a rope is also another great tool that you can use when you're out there. You can toss that rope to somebody that's in the ice that may have fallen through. They most likely are not going to be able to hang on to it. So if you can have them wrap their hand, one hand only, around, and then you can hopefully pull them out, that wrapping will actually allow them to be able to maintain control of the rope as they're coming up and out of the hole. So those are absolutely two essential items. Now, one of the other things to be aware of, out of Moraine State Park, throughout the lake, at almost every single access,
mm-hmm.
the park has rescue tool station. Those can be ring buoys or throw lines, and there's always caution information provided there to hopefully alert people to the safety concerns of going out onto the ice.
Can you talk about, Chris, we mentioned earlier in the program that you are the lead water rescue instructor trainer, and you've been doing this since 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what that looks like when a water team, like yesterday, when a water rescue team is called in? You mentioned that it does take a while for them to get there, so there's that. But when they do arrive on scene, do mm-hmm. they just, I'm assuming they don't just run out, that there's certain steps that they take before they even get to you?
Right. One of the things that we preach in terms of rescue tactics is a rescue sequence. And basically it goes from the safest form of rescue to the most dangerous form of rescue. So you may be able to talk a person out of the hole, meaning that, you know, they're physically, you got there right at time, and you can give them some directions, maybe slide a set of ISOLs out to them, and they might be able to self-rescue themselves.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times these individuals fall through the ice actually very close to shore, and the reason being is that ice at the shoreline forms first. Ice at the shoreline actually goes away first. So we might be able to use a shore-based tactic. We might be able to use a throw bag or what we call a multi-directional tether system. So our rescue personnel don't go out onto the ice mantle. We toss something to the individual and we pull them up and out of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
We then go to a boat, okay, and we use the boat as a platform. We can slide the boat out. That boat gives us a great way to distribute our weight over a large surface area. And we can maybe slide the boat right out to the individual and grab a hold of them, pull them up and get them in the boat, and the shore team pulls us back. And then finally, there's you move into the most dangerous part, and that's where we do what we call ice-based, where I'm crawling right out maybe within 6 to 8 feet of the individual attempting to use an ice staff, or I may actually have to enter the water and physically manage the victim and have the shore team pull myself or whoever out of the hole and across the ice to safety. And the last thing is the utilization of a helicopter. But, I mean, you're talking that's more for flood management.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those are the tactics that we use. That assessment occurs quickly. I get there. I evaluate the scene. And, you know, I make a quick decision, and then we engage.
Mm-hmm. If it unfortunately switches from a rescue to a recovery, like the incident yesterday, you obviously had to put dive teams in the water. How long were they in the water before they were able to recover this victim's body?
Well, there's one thing regarding a recovery. When we move into recovery operations, everything goes slow and controlled, and that's absolutely what we did yesterday. The assets were staged. We had primary divers. We had RIT divers. Those were from both Unionville, Beaver Falls, and Murraysville was also there as well. The one thing that's different regarding ice rescue operations versus someone capsizing a boat at Moraine is that we have a really good point last seen. And that point last seen is the hole in the ice. We had our personnel in there probing, attempting to try and find the individuals before the team got there. But unfortunately, when we had gotten there, the individual was already under the water. So the dive team, we do slow and controlled. That's their operation. They put the diver in the water, and it did not take them long to find the individual and bring him to the surface, and then we were able to get him on the Manawan and back to shore for the family members.
Mm-hmm.
If you find yourself, Chris, as a bystander in this situation, like there was one yesterday up at Lake Arthur, what's the protocol that they should take?
Bystander did absolutely what he should have done, which was call 911. And the reason being is that what I mentioned before, that water is brutally cold. The individual who fell through the ice their energy is being drawn out of them. The faster assets can move to the scene, the better. So a 5-minute delay, a 10-minute delay, you know, get on the phone, call 911, stand back. Don't become a second victim.
Mm-hmm.
Encourage the individual to hang on, okay, and just communicate with them. If there's resources there, like if there was a ring buoy or something that could potentially be tossed, you know, absolutely do that. But call 911. Butler County has a water rescue team, Team 300. That asset moved. Unionville moved. And then the state park contacted additional resources to come in when we transitioned to the recovery mode.
That has to be, you know, that has to be horrific too for the bystander. And I know you aren't the first person to tell me that that individual did everything that they should have done. But, you know, how awful to witness that and know that you really can't do anything. I mean, you mentioned you could talk to them and potentially toss a buoy out, but that has to be horrific to watch.
It is a challenge, but I commend the individual who made the phone call. He got the assets moving, and then, you know, he did not become a second victim.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's challenging enough. I've been in situations where I've had to talk to family members, and the rescue op or the recovery op is a challenge in and of itself. Talking with family members and letting them know what you're doing is probably the most challenging part of the job.
Sure.
That the first responders do.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure. Just real quick, Chris, we just have a couple more minutes left with you. Mm-hmm. Talking about being a second victim, I know that you tell people to keep your pets on a leash if you bring them to the park with you, because unfortunately many pet owners have lost their own lives trying to rescue a pet that has fallen through.
Boy, I cannot overemphasize that. you know, if the dog sees something out on the ice, be it a waterfowl or, you know, they just scamper away from you and they're not on the leash, they can plunge through the ice as well. And then what happens is that I know, just like all pet owners, you have a love for your animal and you don't want to see anything happen to them. Now they, just like a human, can't get out of the ice. And so there have been multiple incidents where pet owners have ventured out onto the ice and become a victim. They've had to be rescued, and they've also had to have been recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of those instances, the pets were recovered or rescued, and the victims or the pet owners were recovered. So the same thing, if you have an animal go through the ice, call 911. The water rescue team would be coming out to do that, as to do a rescue op for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because we also know when that's out there, somebody on the shore is going to go out and attempt to try and get that animal. And then the situation is now worse.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thank you so much. You
sure.
have such a knowledge of this, and it's, you know, it's timely because of the unfortunate incident that happened yesterday, and you know what could potentially happen in the months to come. A lot of people, you know, visit the park, especially in the winter months, and I think it's really great to get this type of information out there.
Yeah, and I appreciate you sharing the information with your listeners, and hopefully it will help out. For additional information and resources, the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, on their website, has information regarding ice safety. So that might be a place that individuals can go for additional information. But I appreciate the opportunity to speak with both of you and your listeners.
Absolutely. Chris Calhoun, BC3 professor and coordinator for the Park and Recreation Management Program at the college. He's also the lead water rescue instructor trainer. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. I'm Kayla Molzan, joined alongside Tyler Friel, filling in for Dave Malarkey today on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR 680 AM. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, I'm going to sit down with someone from AAA to talk holiday travel. Is it too late? Where should you go for winter of next year? Early 2018, January, February, March. A lot of people like to get out of Western Pennsylvania and head south. We're going to talk to Marita Williams from AAA about her early 2018 travel forecast. It's all coming up. Stay with us here on It's Your Turn, WISR 680 AM in Butler, Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to It's Your Turn. Tyler Friel with you, WISR 680 AM in Butler. Big thanks to Chris Calhoun for taking that time and joining us. We are going to switch gears a bit as we are going to talk a little AAA. What AAA? We're not talking AAA baseball. We're talking AAA travel, as it is the holiday season, of course, and I'm sure many of you are on the road as well. So what we want you to do, we want to make sure you take these holiday tips and use them. Kayla had a chance to sit down and chat with a member of AAA, Marita Williams, about some holiday travel tips and different things like that. So make sure you stick around for an interview on holiday travel. That's all coming up next right here, WISR 680 AM.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot is home to the tastiest turkeys in Western Pennsylvania. And this holiday season, Dave Jones is offering a special as a thank you to his loyal customers throughout the years. From now through December 19th, the Jones Turkey Farm is lowering the price of a frozen turkey from $3.25 per pound to just $2.50. That's right. The best turkeys in Western PA can be yours for just $2.50 per pound. Visit JonesTurkeyFarm.com to learn more. Make your holiday season merry by getting a Jones turkey for the whole family to enjoy.
Welcome back, listeners, to It's Your Turn here on WISR 680 AM. I'm Kayla Molzan, joined earlier alongside Tyler Friel, filling in for Dave Mularkey today on the program. Thanks for joining us and staying with us. We've had a lot of great guests, and we have yet another one coming up. We have Marita Williams on the phone. We're going to get her connected up and talk holiday travel. She's from AAA, and I'm excited to talk with her. So we know that winter is here, and we have a lot of white stuff out there on the roadways and on the sidewalks. A lot of people might be thinking, you know, it's time to get the heck out of here.
Right, right.
We've brought in Marita Williams with AAA. Marita, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
What does the holiday forecast look like for Christmas? I know we're just a short time away, but if somebody's like, you know, I just want to go somewhere different, I haven't booked yet, do you say it's too late, or is there still some light at the end of the tunnel?
I don't think it's ever too late, as long as you're flexible. Usually our travel agents are experts at finding something to fit what your likes are, what your budget is. But obviously, the earlier the better. But I don't think it's ever too late to get something done for our clients. Obviously, it might be a little pricier because you've waited a long time. But sometimes there's even some last minute fire sales going on. So sometimes it's even advantageous to wait. It's kind of like throwing the dice.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of agents, when we're speaking of flying in particular, they say to maybe look at flying on the holiday itself. Either it's, you know, even Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, New Year's Day. Do you find that to be not as chaotic at the airports?
Those are good days to travel when you have waited a while to make your plans. Sometimes that is the best that you're going to get, is actually on the actual holiday. Or like the red eyes, sometimes we can find a little bit of space on those and maybe get a little bit better flight. But the actual holidays themselves, like Christmas Day, New Year's Day, New Year's Eve night, those are still available for most destinations.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, it's tight, so you want to get those in ASAP. Almost the middle of the month here, so we're kind of running tight as it is, but not saying it's impossible, but I'd highly recommend talking to a travel agent or logging on to the AAA website. We have a booking engine on there for air, car, and hotel.
Okay. Do you find that as far as traveling on the holiday itself, on the roadways as well, is that a good time to do it if you have some flexibility?
If you have some flexibility, yes. And I'm a good example of that because I live here in the Pittsburgh region and my family's in Ohio. So when we travel back and forth for the holiday itself is always less traffic, especially mm-hmm. on that turnpike.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's less than what you would do if you were going a day or two ahead of time. And our national, AAA National puts out some stats. And they say that the worst days to be traveling on the road for the holidays are like the 20th and the 21st, that Wednesday and Thursday prior to. Those are the most traffic jams, high intensity, a lot of cars and trucks on the road at that time period.
Okay. So you think those will still be the busiest day? I know since Christmas falls on a Monday this year, I wasn't sure. You know, people usually do take a few extra days.
Right, right.
But that's the middle of the week
before. And
they've
already got that long weekend with Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Right.
So it's backed up now to a few more days. So, yeah, it is. Most people take, especially if they're traveling more than 50 miles from home, they're usually taking a little bit of extra time.
Has AAA found that most people will still be driving to their holiday destinations this year versus flying or, you know, by train?
For 50 miles or more from home, they will be traveling mostly by car. But the stats are looking very good. We're estimating that the volume for year-end holiday travel has grown 21.6 million, which is an increase of 25%.
Wow.
And it's the largest record that we've had in recent years for travel during the Christmas holidays. So AAA National is forecasting that there will be 107.3 million Americans taking to planes, trains, and automobiles for their modes of transportation during the holiday period. Again, most of them that are going 50 miles or more from home are driving, which is an increase of 3% over last year. The air travel is expected to increase a little over 4% over last year, with 6.4 million Americans taking to the skies. So that's pretty high. That's kind of why that we're having struggles getting people on planes, because I know most people don't realize that there's still a lot of flights, but a lot of the airlines have reduced the number of seats that they have. So it's imperative that you try to plan a little farther in advance, especially during the holiday season. And then the rest of those stats are coming in with cruise ships, trains, and buses. So they're looking for an increase there of 2.2%. 3.6 million travelers on cruise ships, trains, and buses, which I think that says a lot, that the travel business is back in full force after we had a little bit of a hard struggle last year with, you know, the election and all kinds of different things going on. But it's been a busy time for our agents this year, happy to say.
Yeah, that's an increase across the board. I mean, that means that, you know, the economy is doing well for most people and people have the extra funds to travel.
Right, exactly.
Thanksgiving travel was up as well, correct?
Yeah, definitely. Thanksgiving travel was up. I don't have those stats in front of me, but it was up year over year as well.
What does the gas price forecast look like for people who, as you mentioned, who are traveling more than 50 miles? Are they going to be paying more than last year, a little less, about the same?
Well, the December national average is $2.27. That was December 1st through the 13th, which is a 28 cents more than it was last December for the average. So the good news is that we're expecting the average to drop another 5 cents by year end, which will save, you know, a little bit here and there, but hopefully that trend will continue into the new year.
Once we get through all the holidays and we start 2018, a lot of people, especially being here in Western Pennsylvania, it gets kind of dreary in January and February and even early March. If they're looking to book a vacation to get out of town, specifically to get to some warm weather and head south, have you guys looked at what will likely be the top go-to destinations for early 2018?
Yes. In every year, what we call wave season is January, February, and March. And that is the peak time to be booking cruises, not necessarily to travel at those times, but it is the peak time to book cruises for the coming year. And that's when you're going to find the best deals. And most of those deals include travel during those the first quarter of 2018. So chances are you're going to get a really good cruise deal. But we also have the top destinations where people are flying, and some of those are the all-inclusive resorts of Riviera Maya, which is in the Cancun area in Mexico, as well as Punta Cana. Those are top destinations out of Pittsburgh region, International Airport, going south and getting some of that warm weather. Our all year long, our top destination from the Pittsburgh International Airport is Orlando. So, I mean, it's not as warm in the first quarter, but it's better than here.
I was going to say, it's warmer than up here.
But you know what? That's my favorite time to go to an amusement park, because the lines aren't long and you can wear a sweatshirt. You're not sweating, you know, waiting and walking through the park. So there's some good advantages to that.
Absolutely. I have been to Orlando in the end of January, and it was awesome, because it was, like you said, it was a lot warmer than up here, and you weren't dying of heat. You know, it wasn't 95 degrees. It wasn't as crowded. I would highly recommend it.
Me too. We're on the same page there.
How can people reach out to AAA to either, you know, even start planning a destination for next year, or if they know where they want to go, how can you guys help facilitate?
Okay, so we have several different ways. I feel that the best way is to stop in at your local branch and talk face-to-face to a travel agent, because then you kind of get them used to you and what your needs are and what your budget is and what you're looking for. And maybe they have something to suggest if you have no idea, or if you maybe have an idea and you're not sure it's the right time or time frame to pick to go on vacation. So I suggest you visit our local branch. And if that's not possible and you are techie, you can go on to AAA.com. We have a booking engine on there, as I said, for air, car, hotel, even for cruises. But highly recommend that you talk and get to know one of our travel agents, and then you can even call them on your next vacation, because it's good to build that rapport and that relationship, because mm-hmm. once an agent helps you and gets you to where you're going and finds you that great deal, and you build that rapport with them, they're going to be able to reach out to you and say, hey, this is what's coming down the road, a good time to book this type of vacation, or we have a special deal or whatnot. So it's a highly advantageous for the consumers to build that rapport with the travel agent.
I think it's an interesting time because a lot of people, you know, think they can do everything online and they can just do it ourselves, and, you know, we don't have to go to that travel agent. But, it's, you know, there's so much unknowns, especially if you're traveling somewhere that you haven't been. I think it just makes so much sense to talk to an agent, and, you know, they know where you're going. They have the statistics, you know, they know the facts about the place that you don't know as an individual.
Right. And Kayla, a lot of what we hear that are satisfied customers that are working with travel agents is that they save them so much time. Because I know, even for myself, like researching online for maybe it's not travel, maybe it's for a new washing machine or something. Mm-hmm. You go on there, it's mind-boggling mm-hmm. because there's so many opinions, there's so many statistics, you get this kind, get that kind. So it's the same thing with travel. There's a lot of different ideas out there on the big World Wide Web, and there's nothing wrong with doing a little bit of research, but it can become quite mind-boggling.
Yeah, you can. I've assisted my older parents with booking a cruise, and I wish they would have went to AAA because it took
you.
Me days and days and days, you know, to aid them. And it does take a lot of time, especially if you're trying to get the best deal and, you know, go the best time of the year. It's hard.
It is hard. And, you know, we do have close relationships with many travel partners out there, whether it's cruise lines, tour companies, and so forth. So we have definite benefits with those companies mm-hmm. For our clients to book through those. For instance, Royal Caribbean International, when you're booking a cruise with them, we have a benefit with them regardless of which ship and sail you're on all the time, whether it's shipboard credit, specialty dining, or dollars off. And then we also have a quarterly benefit that you pile on top of that, plus whatever's out in the marketplace at that time. Mm-hmm. You can combine all of those things. So that's another mind-boggling thing for the consumers, to know what is combinable with what. So it's another thing that our agents are experts at.
Absolutely. Well, we do have a AAA office right here in Butler, right by the Clearview Mall in Center Township. So we invite people to go up there or call them. Marina, I'm excited. I want to go on a trip now.
Aw, well, go in there and see our agents. I know Lynn's one of our top agents in there, and she'd be happy to talk to anyone.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a Merry Christmas and be safe out there.
You as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's Kayla Molzan filling in for Dave Mullarkey today, joined earlier alongside Tyler Friel. And up next, after we take a short break, Tracy Morgan is going to replace us in the studio, and she will have the last half-hour segment on today's program. So stay with us. It's Your Turn here on WISR 680 AM. At Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, our orthopedic surgeons, sports medicine specialists, physiatry, and rheumatology experts are committed to your health. Whether it's joint pain, a sports injury, a workers' comp injury, or you need help managing your arthritis or chronic pain, their physicians provide high-quality care to patients in 7 locations, including 2 right here in Butler and 1 in Slippery Rock. Tri-Rivers accepts most major insurance plans, including Highmark and UPMC. Learn more at TriRiversMSK.com. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
A quick word from your friends at Butler Motor Tours, a local company on South Monroe Street in Butler, online at butlerbus.com. Your headquarters for deluxe motor coach tours, outstanding show and theater packages, hundreds and hundreds of fun destinations. And with the holiday season upon us, here's a gift-giving idea. How about a gift certificate for Butler Motor Tours? You don't have to select the destination for the person that you're gifting. No, just give them a gift certificate and they can put it toward the vacation of their choosing. Get the details at Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. By the way, they're also taking a one-day trip down to the Pennsylvania Farm Show again on January 7th. Get the details on that at their website, butlerbus.com. For holiday gift giving, yes. Butler Motor Tours, 282-1000 or online at butlerbus.com, butlerbus.com.
Concordia Visiting Nurses is a Medicare-certified home health agency offering services provided by healthcare professionals like registered and licensed practical nurses, physical, speech, and occupational therapists, home health aides, and many more. We also provide specialty services like palliative care and telehealth monitoring. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
Big thanks to Kayla Molzan for taking that time to sit down with Marita Williams of AAA. We're going to adjust the conversation. Did you know there is a honeybees problem going on in western Pennsylvania? Well, neither did we until Tracy Morgan had a chance to sit down with a member from the Country Barn Farm in Gibsonia and talk about the honeybee crisis. That's all coming up next right here on WISR's It's Your Turn.
Welcome back to the program. Tracy Morgan in with you for Dave Malarkey and, of course, the whole entire team in on this effort with Kayla, Tyler, and myself, as well as Ryan. So thank you very much for joining us while Dave is on vacation. We're going to take a half hour and sit down and talk about honeybees and honey. And I found a great interest in this a couple of years ago when there were some health issues within the family, and I decided, okay, I'm going to look into this honey thing. And then all of a sudden, I started thinking, I don't know the first thing about honey at all. I mean, I'm looking at this whole shelf of just different brands and different colors, and then there's the honeycomb. And so what we're going to do is kind of just get into the honey. What's the best honey? We'll just explain it all. Plus, there have been plenty of stories about the lack of honeybees, and also that honeybees have been dying. So, with us from the Gibsonia area.
That's right. O'Hara Township.
O'Hara Township, so close by, just below Butler County, mm-hmm. is Joe Skrzynski, and he has the Country Barn Farm. And you can visit online if you'd like, countrybarnfarm.com, but it's even better to go visit because, Joe, you have a lot of educational classes, and we'll talk about that. But first, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
It is nice to have you here, and I want to address the stories first about honeybees that are dying and this kind of imbalance.
Let's start with the bad stuff.
And let's end up with the positive. But that is creating an imbalance, isn't it?
Right. So honeybees have had a worldwide decline. We've had a decline here in Pennsylvania. We lost approximately 40% of the beehives last winter, the winter of 2016-2017. And originally, the initial declines around 2006 were attributed to something called colony collapse disorder, which is believed to be a constellation disorder that has several factors. We know that it's characterized by a very small cluster of bees. The bees seem to decline for no clear reason. You go in and you'll find some bees, you find a queen, but otherwise the hive looks healthy. It looks like everything should be going great, but the bees decline in numbers.
The queen is still there, or the queen is
dead
at this
point? Present.
Okay.
Queen is still present.
Okay.
Yep. So that's kind of the hallmark. That's the way they identified in the field. Fully functioning hive, but just not enough bees to maintain hive maintenance, hive operations.
Are there bee researchers out there trying to figure out what's causing the death
of these
bees?
Yes. For over 10 years, beekeepers have been looking at colony collapse disorder, and it's believed to be four primary causes. One is pesticide use, habitat loss, just maybe poor nutrition for the bees. There are two pathogens that have been found in something like 95% of the cases of colony collapse disorder. One is insect iridescent virus. The other is Nosema serrani. What's not known is if these two pathogens are primary causes of the disease or secondary infections. And, of course, there's the varroa mite, which is a parasite that was introduced to this country from Asia around 1990 that feeds on the hemolymph or blood of the bee, weakens the bees, and also as it feeds on the bees, transmits viruses. So those four primary causes are believed to be the primary causes of colony collapse disorder. The bad news is we still don't really know what the exact cause of it is. The good news is it's kind of subsided. For whatever reason, we don't see a lot of cases of colony collapse disorder. Hive loss is still present, but it's not conic lapse disorder. It's just overall stress and strain on the bees, we believe.
So why is that important to, I say us, you know, those who like the honey but don't really invest our time in the education of bees?
Sure.
You know, how does the imbalance affect us?
Right. Well, honeybees are responsible for every third bite of food that we eat. So every third bite of food that we eat is directly attributable to the honeybee. And that's because honeybees pollinate fruits and vegetables, but they also pollinate seed crops. You can't have a lettuce seed to plant in the ground and grow a lettuce plant unless there's a honeybee to pollinate the flower to produce the seed. You can't have clover to feed livestock unless there's a honeybee to pollinate the flower, produce the seed for the farmer to plant. So it's really far-reaching what honeybees do for agriculture in this country.
And I'm just intrigued on how you become a honeybee keeper, and we'll talk about that in a moment because you focus on that at your farm. How many bees do you have?
I have 65 full-size hives, and I raise queen bees to sell to other beekeepers. So I expand those hives out to about 250 what are called mating nuclei, to specific small-size hives specific for queen production. And then in wintertime, I overwinter them as larger hives and break kind of split them out again in the spring.
So do bees have to stay within a geographical region, if you will, mm-hmm. like the bees in the east have to stay in the east, or can they travel out to California?
That's a good question. So one of the great things about the modern hive, we most beekeepers are keeping bees in what's called the standard Langstroth hive, developed by Reverend Lorenzo Lorraine Langstroth in 1861 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So pretty cool. The modern beehive was developed right here in Pennsylvania, and that's what most beekeepers keep their hives in. And the great thing about the Langstroth hive is it's highly portable. You can close up the bees in the evening and move them to a new location, and the bees will go on orientation flights and very quickly orientate to that location. For example, the almond crop in California is a very big pollination crop for beekeepers. Approximately 80% of the hives in the country are moved to California for almond pollination. These are large commercial beekeepers with 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 beehives, and they move them there for almond pollination. One of the interesting things about almond pollination as it stands right now in this country, that crop generates more revenue for beekeepers than all the honey produced in the whole country. So one crop in one state generates more money for commercial beekeepers than all the honey. So really, when you're talking about how commercial beekeepers that are more migratory, larger than my operation, that's how they generate most of their revenue is pollination contracts.
So if I'm understanding you by listening to what you're talking about, bees kind of have that sense of where their colony is,
mm-hmm.
and so they kind of sense how to get home, if you will.
So that's a great question. So this is believed to be one of the factors in colony collapse disorder or the worldwide die-off of bees because of a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. They're developed to inhibit an insect's ability to navigate. Well, bees range up to 3 miles from the beehive. They navigate based on the position of the sun and geographical features and the terrain. And if they're off even by 1 degree coming back to the beehive, they'll miss it by a quarter mile, and that's just more time they have to spend trying to get back to the beehive, and maybe they don't make it back at all. So that's certainly pesticides are a big factor for beekeepers. And when beekeepers select locations, you're thinking about how the bees are going to get out to the nectar resources and get back quickly, because the more trips they can make, the more honey they can generate and also store more honey for themselves and for the beekeeper. And the beekeeper just takes the excess, what the bees produce above and beyond what they need. And that's one of the many amazing things about honeybees is they have a strong hoarding instinct. They store much more honey than they need. Average production in this country is about 35 pounds of honey per hive per year. And that's just above and beyond what the beehives need. They need about, at this latitude, they need about 60 to 80 pounds of honey to make it through the winter. And the beekeeper just takes the excess.
I'm glad that you mentioned the winter, because that was going to be my next question. How do they make it through the winter?
They're truly active.
They don't have coats from, mm-hmm. you know.
yep. From an entomology standpoint, the honeybee is what's called a eusocial insect, active year-round, doesn't have a dormant period, doesn't overwinter in a cocoon or hibernate like a bear. It overwinters active. They form a dense cluster, and they slowly metabolize that honey they collected over the summer and generate heat. And to support brood rearing, they have to maintain a brood nest temperature of about 96 degrees. So the center of all my beehives, the end of January, are all 96 degrees. It may be 10 degrees below zero, but the center of those beehives, they're 96 degrees to support raising bees based on the photoperiod to get ready for the flowers that are going to bloom the end of February, beginning of March, into April.
So beekeepers don't have to do anything extra, in a sense. Like, you don't have to have an extra light, extra heat.
We generally don't provide a supplemental heat source. There's been some research studies where they've added extra heat to try to overwinter bees in Alaska or extreme northern conditions where it typically isn't possible. But at this latitude, we don't provide any supplemental heat. I will wrap my hives sometimes with insulation to give them a little, to help them utilize the honey a little more efficiently. The same way a large hollow tree would have a significant amount of insulation.
Yeah, it's one of those animals that are so fascinating because we take them for granted that they're buzzing around all the time.
Right.
But what they do is just fascinating. Joe Skrzynski is with us. He has the Country Barn Farm, and you can visit at countrybarnfarm.com or actually go to his location just a little south of Butler County, 412-225-0930.
Right, that's my home number. Our hours are by appointment. We don't have a store or anything like that. But we do teach 3 beginning beekeeping classes a year, an advanced class, and we have a bee club that meets at the local library once a month.
I love it. So let's talk about honey. Okay, so there's a lot of questions about honey. Let's first get into the differences in the very, very light honey.
Okay.
And then you got, I'll say medium colored, and then you got this really dark honey. What's the difference?
Right. There's flavor differences. Every flower produces a unique nectar with a unique complement of essential oils and colors and flavors. It's really flower specific. So honey from a canola flower is going to be very different from honey from an orange blossom or honey from a clover flower. And those are actually all light, very light colored honeys. Flavor is really important. We're gearing up for the State Farm Show. I'm entering honey, and my 4 kids always enter honey in both the Butler County Farm Show and the State Farm Show in Harrisburg. And you would think we've won lots of ribbons, but it's not based on flavor. It's based on chemical physical properties. And one of those.
Oh, really? That's how they judge it?
They judge it based on the clarity, the amount of crystallization, how well the jar is filled to the ideal fill point, the viscosity of the honey, moisture content, that sort of thing.
Okay. So
flavor is a factor, but it's only 10 out of 100 possible points.
Then what's the difference in having solid honey and liquid honey?
Okay.
And yeah. I don't know if I'm using the terminology, so correct me in the terminology, because I see it as solid versus liquid. But then I also see raw on the label, but I've seen raw solid and raw liquid. So explain all of that.
So all honeys will crystallize. Honey is 40% fructose, 40% glucose. Well, let's jump back to what the bee does.
Okay.
So the bee leaves the beehive, visits the flower, collects nectar from the flower, brings it back to the hive in something called a honey crop, which isn't their true stomach. It's kind of called, from a biology standpoint, a four stomach. It's basically a storage sack where they transport the nectar back to the hive. And on the way back to the hive, they add an enzyme to that nectar called sucrase. Nectar is collected as sucrose sugar, with flavors and trace nutrients in the nectar, but this enzyme sucrase cracks that sucrase molecule into its 2 component sugars, fructose and glucose. And then the bees bring that processed nectar back to the hive, then dehydrate it down to the ideal moisture content, about 18% water, the same way we'll dehydrate maple syrup sap into maple syrup, maple tree sap into maple syrup. Bees will dehydrate the nectar into this thick, viscous material we call honey. We use as food. So it's 40% fructose, 40% glucose, 18% water, and the rest is trace sugars, nutrients, minerals, and the color and flavor of the honey. The honeys will crystallize because the glucose tends to crystallize. The fructose actually tends to crystallize around any particles that may be in the honey, bits of wax, bits of pollen that may be in the honey, and it'll tend to crystallize over time. Some honeys crystallize very quickly. For example, goldenrod honey will crystallize within a week sometimes, whereas other honeys, there's a famous honey from the south called Tupelo honey that never crystallizes because it has a very high glucose content. So it depends on a ratio of sugars and the chemical physical properties of the incoming nectar determines how fast it's going to crystallize. All honeys will crystallize. All honeys will crystallize eventually. Commercial honey packers, what they'll do is they'll heat the honey and then put it through a high pressure filter to remove all the nuclei from the honey, all the bits of wax, all the bits of pollen, anything that may be in the honey that a crystal can form around, and that'll inhibit the crystallization quite a bit, delay the crystallization for about 2 years. Whereas somebody who produces, like me, who produces a raw, unheated, unfiltered honey, crystallization starts to happen almost immediately. And I tell my customers, I don't mind if it crystallizes because I have four kids, and if honey's crystallized, I don't have to worry about it dripping on the floor.
That's right.
It's a lot easier to handle. So, and if you want maximum flavor, you can imagine every time you heat or filter honey, because the real flavor is in the essential oils in the honey, you're going to lose some of that flavor. So if you want maximum health benefit, maximum flavor, an unheated raw honey that may have some crystals in it is really the way to go.
Okay, so when you say crystallization, I can imagine that. I can picture that. Usually you get that honey jar and you can see that at the bottom, if that's what you're talking about. But I say that because then I'm a little confused on when I see a honeycomb. Mm-hmm. You know, I go into health food stores and there's the honey, you know, a little small packet of honeycomb with the honey. Is that crystallization? Or
it can crystallize in the comb, but typically the bees want it to stay liquid. So the honeycomb is a wax structure that's built by the bees. They have six wax glands in their abdomen and will remove a thin wax scale and manipulate it with their mandibles to build that classic hexagon-shaped honeycomb. And that's where the bees will store the honey, dehydrate the nectar in the comb into that to that ideal moisture content, about 18%, then cap it with a thin wax cap to maintain that ideal moisture concentration to prevent spoilage, because honey is hygroscopic. It can absorb moisture for the air, so the bees maintain a dry condition in the hive, and also cap the honey to prevent any moisture absorption, because if the moisture content goes much above 20%, you can get fermentation in the honey.
So if I'm going to go to the health food store, if I come to you, do you sell those little packets?
Sometimes
with the honey
it's seasonal. If we make it, if we're successful, this year we didn't produce any just because I decided not to make them. A lot of years we will produce it. The honeycomb is really a great way to taste it. I mean, that was probably the most common way to buy honey 100 years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, they still in the South, there's a style of honey that's very popular called chunk honey, where they'll take a small piece of comb honey and put it in a jar with liquid honey to give the customer some assurance that this is the real deal.
Well,
but it's the same honey whether it's in the comb or out, but the comb honey definitely has a certain texture to it. I mean, it has some wax in it that you can consume small amounts of wax. So it's basically the way the bees utilize in the hive is the way it comes in a comb.
What do I do with it? I mean, I'm glad you described, like, taking a piece off and, you know, putting it in the honey. But, you know, I mean, you buy a bottle of honey, you know, you just squirt it out or put it on whatever food or in your tea. When you have the honeycomb, to me, I've never bought honeycomb because I don't know how do you utilize it.
So the way I do it is, or most folks do it, is you can just chew it like chewing gum, and it's got this liquid honey that you consume, and you can either spit the wax out or swallow it small amounts. I wouldn't eat, you know, 10 pounds of beeswax, but the wax is harmless. And I know some beekeepers that really love the really delicate, pure honeycomb, and they'll use it just like butter. They'll just take a scoop of the honey with the wax and put it on some bread and just eat it like that. So a really good, delicate honeycomb has a very nice texture to it.
Is the wax what they use for, like, candles and the lip balms?
Yes.
And that's where they're getting the honeybee wax.
It's about 200 compounds. It's a hypoallergenic material. Only bees make it. It's really an amazing, amazing product.
Yeah. Joe Skrzynski is with me. He's with the Country Barn Farm just below the Butler County line. And he's at countrybarnfarm.com, and he focuses his business with honeybees. And so we're talking about honeybees and getting into honey with the health benefits, because I've heard, so correct me if I'm wrong, you're the person to go to, Joe, that I've heard different colors that you've already described where they're coming from.
Honeys tend to be
healthier.
Darker honeys tend to be higher in antioxidants.
And is that true?
Yes. Same way red wine tends to be higher in antioxidants than white wine. Darker honeys have more antioxidants in them and tend to have maximum health benefit.
And I've also heard that if you have allergies, honey can help. It has the possibility to help. And then I've also heard that you should get honey from an area, a geographical area of where you live, to help you the most. True or not true?
Well, I'm not a physician, so I like people to use my honey because it tastes great.
And it's good,
best food in the world. I think an allergist can do a great job taking care of people's allergies, but probably about half my customers seek out the good local pure honey because they do want some help with their allergies. And certainly 30 years ago, it was really common for people to try to buy local honey. And what folks seek out is the honey from the season when they have the allergies. For example, if you have fall allergies, probably consuming honey from the springtime isn't really going to help with those allergies. That you want the honey to correspond with the period when you have the allergies. But you have to be careful. I've had some customers even tell me they have honey, because there is pollen in the honey that the bees collect, they'll get a little slight reaction from the honey. So I tell folks, if they're using it for that, be careful, because I don't want anybody to hurt themselves. You got to go easy with it, because it does have pollen, and pollen can be highly allergenic.
Can you get the same reaction off of the other products, like the lip balm or the hand cream or, you know, candles?
Typically not, because those are, you know, wax is treated a slightly different. It's heated and filtered, and the route of exposure is different. You're not really consuming a cosmetic the way you would honey. So possibly there is honey, for example, you've probably seen that really nice lemon color to beeswax when it's made into
yes.
a candle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that color comes from pollen. It's the beeswax, when it's actually produced by the bees, is almost clear, kind of an opaque, clear material. But as it's in the hive, it becomes inundated with pollen. So that yellow color comes from the pollen. So there's pollen in there, but it's not really consumed. When it's in cosmetics, it's not really consumed that way.
Oh, okay. So let's talk about being a beekeeper. And it's not just because you're here, but I'm glad
okay.
you are here to
yeah.
ask. But I've had friends who say they wanted to start this up.
Mm-hmm.
I do have one, you know, family, friends of ours, that they did start this up.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how in the world do you start the process of becoming a beekeeper within your own, I say home, but, you know,
sure.
wherever you live?
Well, I've been doing it quite a while. I took my first college extension class in beekeeping back in 1976 with my father, who was a beekeeper. And I really like I like beekeeping. I like teaching beekeeping. I've trained about 600 new beekeepers in the past 10 years from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, and Ohio. And there's four basic steps to becoming a beekeeper that have worked for generations. Read a book, take a class, join a club, find a mentor. And I meet all different kinds of folks, and one of my biggest surprises as someone who teaches beekeeping is there's no one path. Everybody has a different way to learn. Some people may take a class, join a club, study the bees, visit different apiaries, and maybe 4, 5, 6 years later actually get their own beehive. Whereas since I sell beekeeping equipment, I'll have people show up in a driveway with a cardboard box full of bees, and they're ready to get going. They're ready to start. Never read a book, don't know anything about it. So there's no really one path, but I know those four steps. Reading a book, taking a class, joining a club, finding a mentor have worked for generations for people to get started with beekeeping, because it's different than other types of agriculture, so it takes a little more study, a little more preparation. You have to have a proper home ready for them. I tell folks it's more work than a fish tank, less work than a dog as far as taking care
of a beehive.
Oh, that's good.
I can identify with that, yeah. So that in between. So how much land should you have? Because here mm-hmm. I am, a
yeah.
novice. I don't know anything
yeah.
about beekeeping, so is it dangerous to put it right next to my house, or
right.
should I have it, you know, an acre away?
Yep. So there are situations that are ideal. I mean, since I'm near Pittsburgh, I work with a lot of urban beekeepers, and bees can be kept in all the boroughs of New York City. That's typically rooftop beekeeping. The biggest risk in an urban area is that the bees will fly out of the hive and then bump into somebody. Maybe get caught in their clothing, get caught in their hair. Then bees can initiate an aggressive response. They feel like you're a predator trying to interrupt the activities of the beehive, and they'll tend to sting. But as long as you can manage that flyway, bees can be kept in very populated urban areas. The state has best management practices for maintaining beehives, and generally they recommend that the beehives be at least 10 feet away from the property line. The hives should not face across the property line so people don't accidentally walk in front of the beehive. If it's going to be less than 10 feet, there should be an impenetrable barrier of some sort. But one of the many amazing things about beekeeping is you don't have to own any land to be a beekeeper, because usually growers, farmers are happy to have bees. For example, I have one apiary at our house, and then I have 14 other locations where I keep the bees. And generally the value proposition is the landowner gets the pollination and I get the honey. And I'll give them some honey to kind of sweeten the deal, but generally that people are happy with that, because the bees are one of the few animals in this world that actually improve their environment. The flowers that bees visit become more fruitful, produce more seed, produce more fruit, which benefits the honeybees in the form of more flowers, but benefits the entire ecosystem, where some animals will consume everything till it's gone. Bees actually improve their environment, improve the ecosystem. So they truly are beneficial insects.
So my next question is probably a question you have gotten a gazillion times.
Okay.
So I'm not going to ask how many times people have asked you this, but how do you not get stung?
I tell my new beginning beekeepers, you can expect to be stung about once a month.
Okay. So no matter
what you do, there's going to be a stray. Even if you have a suit on and gloves and every form of protection you can think of, you know, 40,000 bees in a beehive, the odds of there being a stray bee on the outside of your suit that happens to sting you when you're taking it off, it's possible.
Well, then let me specify then.
Yeah.
How do you not get stung when you're in the midst of it?
Right.
Because you're there, you have your bees,
right.
You have the honeycombs, you have the hives.
And we're out in all kinds of weather.
I mean,
I'm a dad with four kids, and really ideal time to be in a beehive is between the hours of 10 and 2.
Okay.
When most of the foragers, most of the older bees in the hive, are out collecting the products needed to provision the hive. So going at that time, those bees tend to be more aggressive. So when those bees are out working, that's the best time to be in a beehive. So
that you said 10
clear,
to 2 type?
Clear sunny day between the hours of 10 and 2,
okay.
The warmest part of the day. When there's an incoming nectar flow is a nice time to be in there because the bees are really busy trying to protect that harvest, and they're really focused on bringing in the nectar. And the bees are really easy to handle. But when you're a beekeeper, when you're in the hive in and out, you're day in, day out, you're in there in all kinds of situations. So beekeepers always have a smoker with them, which calms the bees.